whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to the second season of Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-ups are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
I'm Larry Blum, Lawrence Blum. I'm an emeritus distinguished professor of liberal arts and education and professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Over the course of my many decades in philosophy, I've worked in three main areas: moral philosophy, race studies, the kind of philosophical angle on race studies, and philosophy of education.
Well, I'm going to ask you a wildcard question just because this is an Iris Murdoch-themed podcast. I happen to know that you're writing the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy entry on Iris Murdoch. How is that going?
It's very, very challenging. The guides for the Stanford Encyclopedia require you to kind of stick within what's already been done on a given philosopher. And ideally, what I'd like to do is to sort of make clear how Murdoch really speaks to issues that are not taken up very much today. And it's very challenging to squeeze that into their framework, but I'm doing the best I can.
Well, she's interesting that way in that she seems to have had a brief impact on people and then to have been a kind of underground figure for a while and therefore still be capable of surprising us. She's certainly been a big inspiration to me and to this podcast. And she starts each episode telling us that philosophy is not self-expression. But she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So this is question one. Does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Well, I always thought that was a very profound point that she made. But I'm also haunted by other passages where she says, I'm never sure whether what I'm doing is merely exploring my temperament or whether I'm actually onto something that's genuinely about the world. So I think that I worry about that a little bit myself. At the same time, I'm not actually sure what she means by the word temperament. I mean, it's sort of something about you personally that means that it isn't necessarily something that's going to apply to other people. But the only way that I can sort of clearly link to that question is to, it sort of took me back to a point very early in my study of philosophy in college. And it relates to your fifth question about people going into philosophy and what are they afraid of? And so I would be inclined to answer that question in terms of my fear, if I can do that within the framework you set up.
Sure. Okay, let's combine the questions. This is as a first, and say something about your temperament and fear and their relation to your work in philosophy.
Yeah, so I came to college not knowing anything about philosophy. I didn't want to be a philosophy major. I was kind of a math major, and I started dipping into philosophy. And one of my first courses was an existentialism course taught by Walter Kaufmann, who was a Nietzsche scholar. And he introduced me to Nietzsche's idea of the slave morality, that sort of the morality that I had taken for granted was actually a sign of weakness and was a weapon in the arsenal of the weak against the strong. And as a quite immature college student, I was extremely rattled by that view of morality. And I was worried that I myself was one of these weak people who was latching on to morality as a way to sort of both cover over my weakness and possibly use that as a weapon against people who were really strong people. And I had this sense of kind of the weak and the strong. Then as I studied more philosophy, and especially when I was introduced to ethics by Joel Feinberg, who was a kind of mentor of mine in college, I felt like studying ethics and seeing that there was a possibility of giving a rational foundation to ethics really helped me to sort of deal with this Nietzschean worry. And eventually that Nietzschean worry, you know, just because I became a more mature person rather than some actual development in the philosophy itself, that worry sort of disappeared, but it really had an important role in my own attachment to ethics as a subject as an undergraduate.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think this is going to blur into question two. So maybe I'll ask question two and we can talk about that and then loop back to Nietzsche if it seems relevant. Because question two is whether philosophy has ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life.
So this is another aspect of my college experience. I wasn't really very happy as an undergraduate. I had friendships, but they were very superficial, although I didn't actually recognize that at the time. And when I discovered philosophy, it allowed me to get through college and get through this kind of unhappiness. I just loved philosophy. And when I took Joel Feinberg's ethics course, and I remember this particular book, I'm sure nobody knows it anymore, by Kurt Beyer, I think it's called The Moral Point of View, you know, and it was one of many books over the decades that tries to ground morality in reason. And I just was absolutely enthralled by that book and by the subject of ethics. And I just would spend all my time reading philosophy and sort of thinking about philosophy. And it, you know, it helped me through an unhappy time in my life when I finally left Princeton. That was really great. That was a great it was a part of my life that I got out of that sort of place that was really terrible for me. And I finally came to sort of understand why it was that my undergraduate career sort of didn't work for me. And it wasn't until I got to Harvard as a philosophy grad student that I feel that I sort of came into my own. But philosophy was the path that got me there.
I have so many questions about that. I mean, one is you said that you had superficial friendships. Did philosophy help you with that part of life? I mean, was philosophy a way to connect with people or forge friendships with people?
Absolutely not. It wasn't. It was a thing I did on my own. There were other quite serious philosophy majors, but I had nothing more than really superficial connections to them. I didn't form like a real friendship around the philosophy where I would spend hours talking to those people. It was really something that I did on my own. And, you know, as I mentioned, I sort of did it with the encouragement of Joel Feinberg, who had sort of called me into his office one day and said, you know, I think you have a real proclivity for this subject, and I would encourage you to keep studying it. And I was a math major at that time, so I followed his advice, and that's part of what kept me going. But there wasn't a community of philosophy students that I was part of. I mean, I did write a book that was somewhat about friendship. This is my first book, but it wasn't coming off of anything that happened to me in college with respect to philosophy.
I have one other question about this that sort of goes back to Nietzsche and slave morality, because you said in describing the fear of buying into slave morality, the sort of fear inspired by Nietzsche, that you eventually lost that fear, but you attributed that to growing up more than to a kind of philosophical revelation. I mean, so it's interesting that you put it that way. I mean, do you think philosophy can address those sorts of worries, or is growing up really where our moral sort of development comes from, or what's the, or do you see the relationship between those two as more complicated than I'm making it sound?
Now that's a great question. I just think that I was very young and unformed. I came to college. I was a year younger than most other people. I'd skipped a grade, and I just was a very unformed person. And in those years between 17 and 21, I just grew up a lot, and that was just more important than whatever philosophy could do. But I definitely think philosophy can address genuine worries in one's life. And you know, I think that I wouldn't be in philosophy if I didn't think that philosophy really enriched your understanding of your world and your understanding of yourself.
Well, I'm going to move on to a question that we've in some ways anticipated, which is about your teachers. So you've mentioned Walter Kaufman and the influence of Joel Feinberg. But I want to ask, who was your most inspiring teacher?
So I just want to say one more thing about Joel Feinberg.
Sure.
In the time that I was at Princeton, he was awarded a fellowship to study at Harvard Law School for 1 year in a program that I think continued for several decades. I'm not sure. I knew other people who did that as well. His getting that fellowship and the idea that somebody in philosophy, that it would be good for them to study some other subject in some depth, that made a really important impact on me. And it made my way of thinking about philosophy always a little bit interdisciplinary. And you know, that's true in the three, you know, the morality, race, and education. All three of those, I've approached them in a, to different degrees, interdisciplinary way. And it really stems from that thing that Feinberg did. But in terms of my most inspiring teacher, it was definitely Rogers Allbritton in graduate school. So when I got to graduate school, I sort of got caught up in Wittgenstein, because at the time, Stanley Cavell and Rogers Allbritton were both Wittgenstein scholars who were teaching at Harvard, and I just got completely taken over by Wittgenstein. And I got to know Rogers. I can't completely retrace it. I was trying to sort of think about it. He was I can't remember the official name of it, but he was a faculty member who lived in a student dormitory. And I was a graduate student who lived in a different student dormitory. I mean, they're called houses at Harvard. And I used to, the houses that we lived in were very near each other. And I would go over his house, to his rooms late at night. And we would often stay up half the night talking. And I discovered later that he did this with quite a few people. You know, it wasn't just me, but he just was an amazing philosophical interlocutor. And he published very little, I think only four, maybe five essays in his entire career. And one of the reasons for that is that whatever conclusion he or anyone else reached, he could always see an objection to it. So he was a real model of a kind of philosophical integrity, where you don't just stay at a place that seems plausible to you, but you have to kind of keep examining it. And I think most of it's been over 50 years now. I can't remember the content of the conversations that I had with him. I'm sure they were sort of perennial philosophical issues, which Wittgenstein takes up in a certain particular kind of way: free will, you know, knowledge. And Rogers was also very interested in the problem of evil, and I'm sure that's something he and I talked about. And it just was so exciting to have these conversations, even if there was no like definite takeaway. You just had more and more questions. And so Rogers really, really inspired me as a person who, he didn't care about publishing. It wasn't as if he was like always trying to publish and couldn't quite do it. It was more like he had this different way of being a philosopher that's sort of impossible now, because you have to publish in order to have standing in the in the discipline, in the profession. And this was at a time where, you know, I'm not sure whether maybe he was the only person like this. I'm not sure. But it just felt like it was a time where you could be, you know, respected and revered just because of your deep thinking and your kind of investment in the philosophical project, which you only carried on in conversations with people. I mean, just to add one more thing, I took a course with him on Aristotle. It might have been on Aristotle's Metaphysics. In the entire course, we only did 8 pages of Aristotle's Metaphysics because he just got so much out of every passage. And he would come in one day and say, you know, this is what we were saying yesterday, but now there's this other point of view about it. So now I'm not sure that's right. And so then he would kind of explore the same passage over, and people in the class would sort of be involved in it. He would kind of involve you in this exploration. It was kind of amazing.
Yeah, he's a really fascinating figure. I mean, there were a kind of handful of philosophers like that. You know, Thomson Clark, I think, was like that, or John Torek, who published very little and then had this gigantic impact. I mean, one of my very favorite, maybe my very favorite philosophy essay is an Allbritton essay called Freedom of Will and Freedom of Action. And I like it because it's both quite profound and historically rich and surprising. And it's also very funny. Was he funny in person?
He was very funny. He was very amusing. I mean, he lectured in this very famous class called Humanities 5, which I was a TA in for 4 years. And he just, you know, he was a wonderful lecturer, partly because he was very humorous, while at the same time being so kind of deeply committed.
Well, everyone should read Freedom of Will and Freedom of Action. It's really terrific. I mean, the last thing I want to ask you about him was, I mean, that description of him as sort of always having an objection, it simultaneously suggests integrity and a different way of doing philosophy, but also the possibility, if not in him, in students, of inducing a kind of paralysis. I mean,
yes.
Did it have that effect on students? Did it have that effect on you?
It totally did. And I'm really glad you asked me that, Kieran. I came to feel it was partly connected to Wittgenstein, that the issues that Wittgenstein was come to grips with were so ultimately kind of intractable that it sort of made me want to engage in a form of philosophy in which I could feel that I was genuinely making some progress in understanding something important about the world. And Rogers, you know, he didn't help with that. You know, it was a little bit of a reaction against, you know, his constant questioning. So it's like, you know, as I moved forward, there was some balance that I always feel like there's a part of me that does need to keep questioning, that I can't just, you know, dash something off and, oh, that sounds interesting, and I'll put it out there. And, you know, I hope to have held on to an important part of his intellectual integrity. But in terms of the way he was in the world of philosophy, I didn't want to be like that at all. It would have been I just could never have done it. It was important to me to feel that philosophy was something that helped you and helped other people understand their lives, understand their society, understand, you know, other people. And I needed to find a form of philosophy that allowed me to do that. And I ultimately did do that, and especially in the race area, which is, you know, so sort of politically engaged. I think it's true in the moral philosophy as well.
Well, talking about the borders of philosophy and its practical significance, I'm going to ask you question 4. What is your greatest non-philosophical achievement?
Well, I'm not sure. I have a definite answer to that, but I'm actually not sure that it's exactly an achievement. I sort of think that's up to other people to decide. But the most striking thing that I did during the time that I was a philosophy professor was to make an arrangement with my local high school, Cambridge Rigid Latin High School, to teach a course there on race and racism for juniors and seniors. It was sort of a college level course. And I was, my three children all attended that school, and I was sort of a known quantity to people there. So that was why they permitted me to teach, even though I had absolutely no background as a high school teacher. And so through teaching high school, one thing I learned was to have tremendous respect for people who teach at the high school and lower level. But this course, which they invited me to teach once, and then having taught it once, they asked me back three more times. So I taught the course four different times. The high school is an extremely racially, economically, linguistically, ethnically diverse school. And that's part of why I wanted to do the teaching there. The second reason was that I had started kind of drifting into the field of education, and I was teaching only one course, but I was having all of these pre-service students whom I was helping to train them to go into the classroom, and it was feeling a bit dissonant to me to have had no experience myself of that. And that's part of my initial motivation for approaching the Cambridge district to do this kind of teaching. But it was also the fact that I was working in the race area by then. That was kind of my primary area. And the diversity of the school was also an attraction. And the class that I had, the composition of the class mirrored the racial demographic of the school itself. So it was something like 40% Black, 1/3 white, 15% Latinx, and, you know, various others. There was a kind of Middle Eastern category at the time, and I usually had a student in that category as well. So I just had never been, I'd never taught a class that whites were a minority. That was really fascinating, but I wanted the class to be an advanced class for what we now call Black and Brown students, because in the integrated schools of that type, there tends to be a sort of stratification where the most demanding classes and the ones that help you get into college the most are much more white than the composition of the school is. And I wanted to flip that on its head. I wanted to have an advanced class that had primarily Black and Brown students in it and only a minority of white students. And the school, you know, approved of that approach. So the four times I taught it, I always had a kind of similar composition like that.
What were the conversations like?
It just was a fantastically exciting form of teaching. High school students are much less censored than college students. And so it was this very, very charged terrain of this rate, you know, racial stuff is really very charged. And a lot of the, you know, Black students had bad interactions with police and in stores where the security people were followed them around. And but at the same time, the students from all the different groups came to have a kind of mode of engagement with each other that was quite respectful and sort of interested in each other. They were interested in what the others had to say. They were kind of excited. I mean, this was something it's not that they expressed this directly, but I felt that they were excited to be having conversations about race that were really substantive with students of other racial groups. I mean, race in schools like that, race is always present in the interactions between the students, you know, in the cafeteria and the hallways. But as a subject of study, that wasn't something they were familiar with. They, you know, knew there was such a thing as African American history or literature, and some of them had taken courses like that. But the idea of studying race itself, and I thought that was something that I could contribute. I was in the social studies. It was a social studies history class. It wasn't a philosophy class, But of course, I was bringing a certain kind of philosophical sensibility to it. And it was totally exhausting. It was so much more work than teaching college. It felt like teaching college was like nothing compared to this. I was just exhausted at the end of every class. I lived within walking distance of the school, and I would have to decompress when I walked home. But I eventually, many years later, decided to write a book about that class because I was so impressed that they were able to have constructive racial conversations, even though they were only 17 years old. And, you know, many American adults, most American adults, I would say, can't have those kinds of conversations across racial lines. And I thought writing a book would sort of show the American adult population that if 17-year-olds could do it, they ought to be able to do it too.
Well, normally at this point, I would ask the second Iris Murdoch question about fear and what you're afraid of, but we've already talked about that. So I think I'm going to just say thank you so much, Larry, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Larry Blum is Emeritus Professor of Philosophy and Distinguished Professor of Liberal Arts and Education at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's the author of several books, including, most recently, Integrations, The Struggle for Racial Equality and Civic Renewal in Public Education. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.